Before we begin this episode, we want to offer a content warning. This podcast will discuss topics that some listeners may find distressing, including mental health struggles and suicide. We believe these conversations are really important, but we also understand they can be emotionally challenging. Please take care of yourself, and if at any point you need to pause, skip ahead, or step away, we completely understand. Details of some relevant support services are provided at the end of this episode. Thank you for being here. Hello, welcome, and thank you for joining us for this special discussion. In veterinary medicine, as in many high-stakes professions, we're often faced with decisions that have to be made under pressure, maybe with incomplete information, sometimes with exhausted teams, and often with very real consequences. Mistakes, near misses, and tough calls are all part of the job, but how we prepare for them, learn from them, and cope afterwards can make all the difference. Today, we're bringing together a variety of specialists from both veterinary and human medicine to explore how different disciplines approach error management and decision-making under pressure. Whether it's in the consulting room, the operating theatre, or on the hospital ward, each of our guests has faced critical moments where the outcome hinged on their choices. We'll hear real stories of moments where things didn't go to plan, insights into how professionals are trained to cope with critical decisions, and reflections on the impact that these pressures can have on our well-being. Most importantly, we hope to share lessons that vets and vet nurses can take back into practice. So today I'm delighted to be joined by veterinary specialists Ricardo and Kelly, along with our medical colleague Christina. So before we dive into our main discussion, can I ask each of you just to briefly introduce yourself and the kind of work you do? So I'm Ricardo, can we start with you?
Yeah, so thanks, Gemma, for this invitation. It's a pleasure to be here with the four of you. So my name is Ricardo. I'm a specialist in small animal surgery. I've been a specialist for 7 years, I think now, but I've been in the specialist world, if we can say, for more than 13 years. I graduated in Portugal, but I did all my training in UK. At the moment, I'm one of the co-founders of a surgical center located in Mallorca in Spain. And yeah, it will be a pleasure to go through this during the next hour with you.
Thank you. And Kelly?
My name is Kelly Blacklock. I am a European specialist in small animal surgery like Ricardo. I work at the University of Edinburgh, where I'm professor of soft tissue surgery. So I do a lot of undergraduate and postgraduate teaching there, and then have a particular interest in head and neck cancer, so do a lot of research in that space too.
Lovely. Thank you, Kelly. And finally, Chris, our medicine colleague.
And Christina Rodriguez. I'm from Portugal. I'm a general human surgeon, and I work more in the gastric cancer and gastric pathology. And I work in a small hospital in the north of Portugal, Viana do Castelo.
Lovely. Thank you. So I suppose to get us started, let's maybe think about early on in our careers, or your careers in particular. And can you maybe think of a moment very early on in your career where you realised just how high stakes decisions could be in your role as a surgeon? Let's go to Kelly.
I think probably it would be my time as a new grad. So I graduated from Edinburgh, and then I was in practice in Nottingham in primary care practice for a while. And it was fairly early on in my career that I realised how high stakes our decision making is, and something that isn't really taught in the undergraduate course, when I was looking after guide dogs, and particularly guide dogs for the blind. And what struck me during looking after those patients is how important my communication had to be with the owners, and how important what I said was for decision making. And there's two dogs I can think of in particular. The first one was a dog who came in with bloat and vomiting, probably because of a dietary problem. But I remember talking to his caregiver about the risk of GDV and the things to watch out for that afternoon, as we were just going to send the dog home and treat him as an outpatient. and having to explain all the things to look out for to a person who was partially sighted was quite difficult. And so decisions, you know, communication had to be pretty flawless in that patient. And then another one that I think that strikes me was a dog who presented around Christmas time. And we've all seen patients like this. Again, it was another guide dog for the blind. And she came in, was brought in by her caregiver who was blind. And the story that I received was her grandchildren were sitting on the sofa and they had an enormous tin of chocolates, Christmas chocolates. And she had left the room and come back and the tin was empty, but the children allegedly didn't know where the sweets had gone. And so she wisely thought, well, probably the dog's eaten them, but I don't know that to be true. So she brought the dog in. We made the decision to make her vomit, and indeed she had eaten the whole tin of chocolates. And if she hadn't been made to vomit, that could be a potentially catastrophic dose of chocolate. But again, it just brings back how important communication is and trust between clinician and client, and having to build that relationship sometimes really early on within the discussion.
Absolutely. I think communication is key. Ricardo, sorry, you go.
Yeah, I think that like all of us during the early years of our career, we are more exposed to these scenarios. I certainly suffered, I think, in the first few years from this Dunning-Kruger syndrome or something like that, where you're a little bit overconfident. And I was so keen to the surgery. The reason why I moved to UK and to try to get my specialization and do my residency and all that was because I was really passionate about surgery. So I was kind of lucky to enter a chain of 3 or 4 practices. And I was mainly doing surgery on a daily basis. But I didn't have much knowledge. So I remember, for example, because there are so many cases that I have, that one of the first X-labs that I did was in a Rottweiler. And that was not even my case, was a case from a colleague of mine in the practice that I was working. So the communication with the client was very little on my end. I remember going to theater with this patient. I didn't find anything. I woke up with the patients. And then when I had to explain to the clients that we couldn't find anything, he was really upset. So to have to deal with that, it brought a few days of darkness. No, because I was upset as well, of kind of breaking the confidence between myself as a provider of a service and on the other hand, a client that didn't understand that sometimes that can happen. And me wondering whether the call was the right one at the time. So was just the perfect storm, I think. But as Kelly was saying, communication, I think that is so important to prevent this kind of situations.
I will share a case too. And that happened in my first years being residence. And I learned 2 things with it. One is communication, the importance of communication with the family and what to expect of the surgery. And even the benign disease, a frequent disease that was a gallbladder stone, can go wrong and wrong and can have a little end. And it's not easy for us, the surgeon, and neither the family, of course. And it was a patient in his 60s, and he came to the hospital to take his gallbladder. Simple, he was okay, little symptomatic, and it's a frequent surgery. Everyone told him, it's okay, let's go. But we had a problem during the surgery. We had a partial clipation of the bile duct that we didn't notice. It was done by surgeons with lots of experience, but this happened, okay? And after he went home, then he started going bad, came to the hospital. And then he went in a cascade of complications that in the end, he died with liver failure. And it was very hard for us, for the surgeon that did that surgery. It was very hard for him because it was a benign disease. Okay. We weren't expecting that. We were expecting the patient to be fine after 48 hours. And I learned that even the simple procedure, the benign disease, everything can happen. And then it's a decision after decision that you don't know, you don't have a right decision. Only one. You have many options. And every time you take one, you have to deal with that. You have to deal with the consequences that your decision creates. And in this case, it was hard for us and the family. They weren't expecting this ending because he came fine. He had no little symptoms, nothing. And nowadays, I explain everything to my patients. I tell them that this is not so easy as everyone tells, because you go to the general medicine and they always say, take it off. You don't need your gallbladder. Take it off. But it's not that easy. Okay? We have to think about it. We have to talk all the complications to the patient and the family and be prepared for it, for everything that happens.
Well, Christina, if I can ask you something, do you only operate cases that you consult, or do you operate cases that colleagues of yours consult?
Yeah, it's different from hospital to hospital. In my hospital, I operate my cases and the cases of my colleagues, because we have a list where when we have a patient to do a cholecystectomy, we put the patient on the list. And then we go for the list, okay? I can't operate mine and let the one that my colleague put on the list stay for 1 month or 2 months more, because he doesn't have an operating room day or something. So I operate mine and the colleague's patients too. But I don't like that. Because it wasn't me who explained the surgery to the patient. I noticed that there are many surgeons, the older ones, that don't always explain everything to the patient. I always tell my patients when they sign the authorization to the surgery that they can die. Okay? Because any surgery, you have that risk. Okay? And sometimes I see things like, oh, it's going to be okay, that's easy, we do it all the time. But even with the surgery that we do all days, every single day, it can be difficult. It can happen. Something can happen and we are prepared for that. And then I don't like
it. Yeah, I find it so difficult to operate a case that either myself or a resident that is under my supervision I find it so difficult to operate without having met the client. I guess that Kelly, you supervise more than me. Do you feel that?
I do. I'm very fortunate in that our department is large, but we're a very close-knit department and everyone thinks along the same lines and has the same sort of, I guess you would call, beliefs and ethics and ways of working. We're all quite similar. So I do operate regularly on patients that I haven't done the consult and I haven't met the clients. And that has caught me out a handful of times. But on the whole, you know, if you work in a department where everyone sort of gets on and thinks the same, that's not a problem. I think it would be really challenging if there was a member of the department who you didn't trust or who does something that's very different to what you would do. Then I do think that would be a problem and I'd be pretty uncomfortable with that. If I'm operating on a patient that was consulted in by another department, and emergency and critical care would probably be the most likely to have done the consult, then usually we'll do sort of a verbal handover in the corridor. Have you done? Have you said this? Have you said this? Have you said this? But again, because we work together so cohesively and for such a long time, they know what I say know what they say. And again, it's all about communication, making sure that at the end of the day, the client has received the information that you need them to receive. But I also, you know, say the same as Chris, every routine patient that comes in, potential risk of death is always on there, you know, ovario hysterectomy, the patient could die, castration, the patient could die. You know, it's not just because it's routine surgery doesn't mean it's routine, right? We can lose them and we do.
Yeah, that is very interesting. I wonder if emotionally you become less attached when you don't know the patient or the owners of that patient. So maybe your process thinking will be more sharp because you are not so concerned. You don't see the emotion behind it, right?
I think that's true. When I encounter a mistake or an error, unexpected complication, you don't have that direct relationship with a client. So I find, you know, that is emotionally easier, I think, for me to deliver the news. And, you know, if I'm the patient who's up, if I'm the surgeon who's operating, I'll be the one to deliver the news. I wouldn't ask someone else to deliver that.
Of course.
But it does make it, you're right, it does make it emotionally a little easier.
Because in my case, I find it sometimes that, you know, and I think that we will eventually talk about this, those moments where you need to be sharp and you will try to do the best that you can for that particular patient. But thoughts come to the background of that patient and we have an owner, which Christina is alienated from this, right? In veterinary medicine, we need to deal with the two aspects, one that is the owner and another one that is a pet that sometimes plays a role as well. No, the patient itself, ours, is dependent on another person, no, which makes it a little bit complex, I think, for us.
We have that on the pediatric patient. I operate pediatric age. For me, it's only for the emergency room, okay? I don't do pediatric surgery, okay? But in the emergency room, appendicitis and things like that, more simple, we do it. So in that cases, I have to talk with the parent, and it's a little bit similar to what you have, patient and parent that is the one that has to take the information, to consent, everything. It's not so easy, yeah.
So do you find it, just to clarify, do you find it more difficult then?
When the pediatric issue, I find it more difficult, yeah. Because we have two aspects. The kid, not the patient, the kid, because depending on the age, he has his own beliefs and what he thinks and what he wants. And then you have the parents that are always anxious. They want everything for yesterday. Don't want to wait. They don't want nothing to go wrong. And it's not that easy to deal with the parents. Yeah, I prefer the older ones. I prefer the over 18 because it's easier for us to deal with them. Yeah.
It's interesting because we in our family have had a recent pediatric healthcare journey and the similarities were interesting because the medic had to call us and had to make a relationship with us extremely quickly. And some of the things that I learned from her, I've taken directly into my practice as a veterinary surgeon. You know, she had to get us on side. She had to make us trust her pretty quickly. And she did that by very much involving us in the decision, making sure that we had absolutely everything, not assuming that we knew anything, but not assuming that we were stupid at the same time. Really finding a balance to get us on side pretty quickly. And I think we do that in veterinary medicine, but I hadn't experienced it. And that's a really important part of the journey, trying to build that rapport, sometimes within 10 minutes, and sometimes in the emergency situation on the phone as well. And that can be really hard to try and build trust instantly over the telephone. It's very difficult to do.
Yeah, 100%. I feel that bond needed to do the best that we think for that patient is easier to do if you do it personally. certainly that there is situations where you need to do it over the phone, but I can feel that engaging moment of trust to be much easier if it's one-to-one. And mm-hmm. and then understanding the other type of person that we have in front of us. I remember that one of my supervisors will spend 45 minutes of the consult talking about complications, and another one will spend 10 minutes. Mm. And I'll try to understand why they were so different approaching that. So in the end, I think that depends a lot on the other type, on the type of person that you have in front of you. Because if they understand the risks that are involved and they are sharp understanding them, I think that we move on and maybe we go on different subjects of related to the surgery, not so much on complications. And one of my supervisors will say that until they cry, they didn't understand this. The procedures, yep. which make me laugh, right? But I think that you need to be very straight with them for yep. them to understand, as you are, Christina, that even a routine or elective thing can go wrong. And what I find difficult is that the incidence of some of these ones is so low, but they happened. And that as more you do, more likely that you'll get that very low percentage of complications yep. to happen to you. And then you lose a little bit your confidence, I think.
And if you're the 1%, it's your dog or your child or your parent, you know, then it's significant, right? If you're the one that's affected, then it's a problem.
If I knew the one that will complicate, I don't operate that one. Yeah. But we don't know. So you have to take the risk. Yeah. The ones that take the risk are the patients, but we suffer with that. We are, the people believe we are cold-hearted or something like that, but we are not. We suffer with the patient when some things happen. We don't show it because we can't. Yeah. But it affects us. It affects our confidence for the next case. It affects our brains. I have bad nights sometimes thinking about what happened, what I could have done different for another ending. It's not easy. It's not easy to deal with the pressure on the ER, the OR, and after that too. Because sometimes if something happens, if something bad happens, I bring the case home. I'm still thinking about it, revisiting it again and again, trying to understand what happened, what's gone wrong, and to try not to do it again, or because it's not our fault, direct fault. We don't do, it's not a mistake. It's the circumstances that happen. It's not easy sometimes.
Are there any not only? Oh, sorry. I was just going to ask, are there any techniques you use to try and help manage that negative mindset after a complication or an error has occurred in your department? What do you do?
In my department, in our service, there's nothing. Like no reunions or no... I think the doctors and the vets, maybe they should have appointments with psychologists sometimes to see if it's everything okay. It's if we are dealing well with our pressure, because we see that the suicide rates and alcohol, drugs are very high in our professional...
The same for us, especially I'm not so much aware of drug abuse, but certainly suicidal rates. I think that in humans, correct me if I'm wrong, I think that you have more drug abuse cases.
The drug and alcohol abuse, even in the residents and the students, the medicine students. Because of the pressure that is put on them. It's too high. And if you don't have background, some support at home and with your friends, the colleagues are very important to help you deal with that. Because they understand what you're going to, what's happening. Because they've been there, they understand what went wrong. They are very important for us to try to go ahead the problem. And, but in the hospital, on my hospital, there's nothing that will help us directly to deal with it. No,
I think that this is where we have a massive cliff, I think, in veterinary medicine. You know, we finish our degrees and then we are thrown into the wolves, sometimes with very little psychological support, I think. And I think that is a difficult transition. Now, if you are lucky to be well surrounded with a team that is supportive, and I think that helps a lot. I think that in our case, in veterinary medicine, I think that we are getting better with the checklists, with M&M rounds, you know. I think that those are tools that I guess that you have that, Kelly, for sure, institutionalized in Edinburgh. It just goes through on near misses and things that could have been avoided. You know, it's like a retrospective check on things that can help running the hospitals and practices. I think that is probably one of the best things that I find in our profession to help preventing mistakes and complications. But on the psychological level, I think that the profession, the veterinary profession, lacks a lot. I think that, as you are saying, we should have more follow-up, I think.
I think it's really important to recognize that everyone feels this way. And I think, you know, within the human surgical and veterinary surgical world, there's papers where people have been asked to assign a descriptors to different professions, to a medic, to a surgeon, or to an imager. And the surgeon is always assigned sort of arrogant, cocky, confident, unapproachable, usually a male. You know, and Chris, you said people will often view us as cold-hearted. You know, these are all typical stereotypes. And the reality is that is not how you feel. You've got to be able to move on to the next patient in the theatre, but that doesn't mean you don't care about the previous one. And so recognizing when something doesn't go to plan, that you're not alone, is really important. And there's a great quote that I like that I read a long time ago by René Lariche, which says every surgeon carries within himself a small cemetery where he goes from time to pray. Chris, you nodded. Every surgeon knows this quote. A place of bitterness and regret where he must look for an explanation for his failures. This was said, you know, years ago. It's true then. It's true today. And it's going to be true in the future. It's hard. But this is, if you do many surgeries, you have complications. That's just an inevitable part of wielding a scalpel. But we do, you know, decompressions and M rounds and morbidity and mortality rounds, where if something doesn't go as expected, we talk about it. We have a format that we follow. It's a very no blame culture. And about half of the time we have these meetings and the takeaway is we did the best we could. Everything was textbook, but the outcome wasn't great. And another half of the time, someone says, yeah, I messed that up. That was my doing. I should have done this or I shouldn't have done that. And having the psychological safety, I think, to be able to say, you know, this was me. I didn't do that well, is very important. Having a high functioning team, having a safe team. And as surgeons, you know, as the stereotypically arrogant, masculine, unapproachable people, we are the one that should be able to lead that, to say it's powerful when we're the ones who can say, I messed that up. I didn't look at the images properly, or I didn't place that suture properly, or I chose not to put this vessel clip here when I should have put the vessel clip there. That's really important, because then when the people you're training come up behind you, they've seen you be vulnerable. And that is normalized as part of the profession. That's really important.
Yeah, I 100% agree. I think that the self-criticism is the way to evolve, isn't it? If we don't look ourselves and try to find excuses to on ourselves, what can be done better, I think that we stop learning, for sure.
Yeah.
And there is also this, now that you mentioned a quote, one of the ones that follow me, is from Atul Gawande.
Yeah.
That's sometimes wrong, never in doubt. And I don't use this to justify my mistakes or to justify cases that go wrong, but to remember myself that things sometimes you have a difficult day or in the circumstances where you are, you could not get the whole information to make you act, or sometimes it's just the way that was meant to be, you know? So I think accepting this prevents me psychologically to go crazy with this little semeter that you're saying we all have, because I have cases that will die with me for sure, that I know that I could have done something different. The problem is when you don't recognize that, or when no one tells you as well, no?
Yeah, and I would encourage, you know, if you haven't read Atul Gawande's work, it's absolutely phenomenal author, really easy to read. You learn such a lot. You can read it as a novel. It's not a textbook read. His books are really incredible. And I guess also, you know, as surgeons, we do cool stuff as well. So it's important to be self-reflective, but also to be able to celebrate some of the cool stuff. Yeah. You know, we're within our team. We'll still go around showing each other, look at my cool x-ray, look at this amazing spray wall, you know, this cool boudoir. So having the balance is really important, I think.
Yeah, I think that is a very good point, because I think that at least in my case, my brain gets much more stuck with the complication ones, with the difficult ones, no? And sometimes I receive a message a few months later from a certain client just saying how thankful they are. And that always makes you feel good, knowing that you help so many lives, but you just need one case to go wrong for you mentally to suffer from it. And I think it's something that everyone should work on, just remembering how many cases you help. We had one recently that died under general anesthesia, completely unexpected. And, you know, it's one of those that happens every 6-7 years, maybe, or at least to me. And that feeling is just awful, isn't it? But they happen. The rates are there, or the frequency is low, but what can happen?
Definitely.
Spoken a lot now about communication and how we manage when errors do happen. But I was just wondering if we could have a think and you could maybe explain your reflections on any training that you received during your residencies or on your pathway to specialization that helped you specifically to deal with decision making under pressure. And how were you taught these skills? Do you think they can be taught in a lecture, or are they only learned through lived experience and through watching your peers operate and how they react under pressure? Or do you think that maybe we could take away some learnings from industries like aviation, where they do a lot more simulations and practice decision making under stress? What are your experiences of that?
In my residence and here in my hospital, we don't have lots of simulations and we don't have lessons to learn how to deal with that. We don't do that frequently. No. In my case, we have residence for 6 years, and I think we go learning with our colleagues, the older ones. They are always during that 6 years, they are always with us. We are not alone, and we are, like Ricardo said, in the beginning, we think we are superheroes or something like that. We can do everything. Nothing happens to us. But then with the years going by, we start to see that it didn't happen because we had someone that was there, an older one that was looking and telling us, go that way, not that way, do this, do that. And we are learning with them. And when things happen, when catastrophes happen in the war or something, we learn with them. They do, how they react. I think that's the way, you know, I learned a little bit to deal with that stressful moment. Yeah, with my colleagues mostly. I don't know about you, if you have simulations or things like that, but no.
So certainly during my training, and certainly now, we have simulations in terms of resuscitation. So we do resuscitation simulations not infrequently, which is super helpful. And then the other thing we try to do is to try and avoid the error or the emergent decision-making in the first place, of course. So the way we do that is with the surgical safety checklists, with timeout before the first cut, introducing everyone in theatre to try and abolish hierarchy within theatre, mentally playing through the surgery, making sure that anaesthesia know where we are in the surgery if we're going to, you know, ligate this vessel or put this clamp on. So trying to minimize risk, of course, and everyone tries to do that. That's how we do it. But again, just spending time with your mentors and with your peers as you progress through your career. And I think how your mentors teach you is very important. I remember this is my first weekend on call as a new resident, and one of the patients who had an orthopedic surgery died in the recovery, presumably because of a thromboembolic catastrophe. And I remember calling my supervisor, being absolutely distraught, thinking that I was going to get shouted at and get, you know, fired. And he just said, you know, you're not Jesus. You can't, you know, there's only a certain amount of things that you can do. And having that realism, calming, someone who's not freaking out, was absolutely imperative within these situations.
Yeah, I agree. I think that is such a complex topic, this one, because I think that we all want the same, no? That is not to have complications and save lives, or improve them at least. And if we are surgeons, we need to pass through a learning curve. And I think that the learning curve is the challenge here. How long it will take to get that learning curve, and how are we going to achieve that learning curve? With which amount of support we're going to get there? I think that that is why residencies, they help. If we are doing surgery or postgraduate courses with some limitations, but I think that is one of the key points, is to get into the learning curve where we understand the procedure inside out, not just technicality, but the types of complications, how to diagnose them. Just diagnosis of complications, I think that is, they can be so tricky. But if you do on a daily basis the same procedure, which Christina, you can jump in, like we have a huge variety of surgeries, not so much in the depth as you in some of them, but I might do a thoracotomy today, a spine tomorrow, and a fracture the following day. So we have so much where to go, you know, that doing one certain procedure a year will make it very difficult to keep the standards on that procedure. Because we might even have already passed that learning curve, but if you stop doing it for a certain period of time, you'll lose hands, you know? And I think that one thing that in human surgery you guys have, and I spent some time with you in theater, surprised how relaxed the environment was until something hit the fan and suddenly everyone goes into full mode. But overall, I saw quite a relaxed environment. So when I would expect as a veterinary surgeon, and then the human side to be a bit more strict, everyone's serious, everyone, you know, no laughs about, no music, or, you know.
No, we have music, we have jokes, everything, yeah. And we have good environment in our. But when something happens, yeah, we will stay focused, and everyone, we talk with them, and everyone go into that mood, full mood of attention, and to go to the right state of the patient and everything, do everything right, yeah. But most of the time we are relaxed and doing our things, everyone joking and medical jokes, yeah, a lot of them, and yeah, so, and sorry?
I was going to say, hopefully, well, I presume, certainly for us, that's because of all the prep work you've done to begin with. First of all, in the residency training, of course, you know, but then you've read the file of this patient, you've chatted to the anaesthetist, you've, you know, you've looked at the imaging, you've done a timeout, you don't just turn up into theatre and
make a start. You know, you've done some planning, you've gone through the surgery in your head to try and make everything as relaxed and nice as possible.
Is this an exercise that you do? Because I find myself in those surgeries that I'm not so familiarized, or even not as is not such a routine surgery, that I do like a mental work the day before, even sometimes. How boring is that? I go to bed and I start thinking.
Yeah, for me, yeah, definitely. I think
it helps. One thing that I'll say is that if I mentally prepare and visualize the procedure and establish a difficulty rate for that procedure, when I encounter complications, my brain has already seen that potentially happening, so that I'll not panic when I'm dealing with that procedure. And I think that instead of winding up and building up stress in theater, that certainly helps me a lot.
I agree with you. Yeah. In most of my days, I work with the same group of people, and we do gastric surgery, the knee and malignant, but my days are around the gastric surgery. But I'm on call once a week for 24 hours, 12 hours. And on that days, I can go from the surgery, gastric surgery. Okay. But I go and do intestinal surgery, breast surgery, neck surgery. I can do everything. And in that case, when the type of surgery is not what I do frequently, it does an appendix and the gallbladder. It's not gastric surgery, but it's frequent for us to do it. But a neck exploration is not that easy. And I'm not used to. I did it on my residence because we have a general surgery. We are general surgeons. We do everything that other surgery specialists don't do. Because we have cardiac surgery, thoracic surgery, vascular surgeons. So what these ones don't do, it comes to the general surgeon to do. Well, we have a lot of pathologies that we have to operate. Okay. But nowadays, not my thing. I don't do neck exploration for so long. But when it comes to my ER, I have to do that you told, Ricardo. I have to think about it. When they are preparing the patient for the OR, I'm thinking about it. I'm talking to my colleague that goes with me to what we will see, what to expect, what will we do if this appears or that. So, yeah, I think that's important to talk, to plan a little bit. Well, that every complication that happens, we are not prepared. Right, to prepare a little bit. Yeah.
And can I ask you one thing to both of you? Do you ever call your patients or owners when you are in theater operating? Have you ever done it? Or is that something that you do sometimes or not?
What do you mean with that? Call the family?
Yeah, well, in your case, yes. No,
during
but
the surgery.
Just the owners, the tutors of the patients.
During the surgery, I don't remember any case where I've done that. No. I talk with them before the surgery. In the emergency, it's more difficult because the family is not there all the time, because sometimes you have to be on the phone. It's not that easy. But I try to talk with the family before I go to the OR with the patient, because in an emergency patient, everything can happen. And I have to tell them that. So during the surgery, if I told them, if I explained everything, it will be easier for me to take the decision. If they, like intestinal surgery, sometimes we have to cut and do a stoma. Yeah. Like
a stoma, yeah.
A stoma. And it's not easy for the patients. The patient to wake up and has a stoma on his belly. It's not easy for them to see. And if you didn't talk about it before the surgery, it won't be good. Okay? It will be a very bad position you'll be in a very bad position with the patient. You won't continue to believe in you and things like that. So I try to talk about every the major complications before I take him to the OR. So when I'm in front of them, I can think about the possibilities because I told them that would happen.
Yeah. And if you'll get, for example, the reason why I ask this is doesn't happen often at all, but sometimes maybe you see things that you didn't expect during surgery. So in those cases, the situation changes a little bit. I'm sure that you can predict to a certain point, and the majority of times you can predict beforehand the type of things that can happen in theater. But it happened to me a few times where I had to do that, you know, because I felt better. And I know that it's putting in under pressure even more the person that needs to make that decision. But if it's something that is unpredictable, that I could not see beforehand, I had to do it a few times. I was just wondering if that happens in the human side, because I think that will be difficult as well.
Yeah, it will be difficult. Sometimes we go to the OR and we don't know what the patient has. And we propose exploratory laparotomy. Okay, like they're going there and see what happens because we don't know what he has. He's not good. So we have to go. We know we have to go, but we don't know what we will find. Maybe it will be an ulcer, a stomach gastric ulcer, and it has a perforation, or it can be your bowel. Sometimes we don't know, but we explained that before. And never I had to go out and talk with the patient's family. I think that we decide. In that case, when we are there, we decide what to do, and then we explain later. We do it for the best, of course, and then we explain it later. Yeah.
I suppose the key difference between medicine and veterinary medicine would be that in our patients, sometimes there is a decision to be made not to wake the patient from surgery if we do find something particularly unexpected that is really detrimental to his welfare. Yeah. And yeah. I guess, Ricardo, that those conversations are probably the ones you're having with your clients in theatre. Would that be correct?
Absolutely. Yeah, you're absolutely right. That goes on the sequence of my question, because I had cases in which the risk beforehand is high, but when I face a nearly impossible survival, if I move my hands a little bit deeper, I will lose the patients, a patient that otherwise could potentially live another 2 months with his owners if I wake him up from the table. So even beforehand, I already told them high risk for death with the procedure. If I realize that that 20% goes to 90%, I probably will be calling the owners just to prepare for them, and then for them to decide, knowing that that case is compromised, you know, in the sense that we will not be able to help much. So yeah, it was more in that sense. I guess that we have this thing of euthanasia, right? So don't know if we can say we are lucky or not. That is cultural. But in humans, you don't have, Christina.
No. We do. That's the difference. We do everything for the patient. We have a public system, health system. So we don't have limits. Okay. Of course, if you have an old patient that is dependent, and we can put some routes to the care that we are giving, okay? But most of the times we don't have a limit for what we offer to the patient, okay? So for us, there's no going back.
It's not an option. Yeah.
Sometimes it is. Sometimes we open the abdomen and we see there's no way to go, like an ischemia or something like that. And we go back and say there's nothing to do and explain it to the family. But the way that you do when you go and talk to the owner, do you want us to go further or not? Not an option for us. Who decides that? It's the doctor who is on the wire. And that's not easy sometimes to go back. So decide mostly on the oncologic patient. It's not easy to go there with an idea that we are going who do a corrective surgery, and then we face with an abdomen with no disseminated disease. And it's not easy sometimes to decide if we go ahead or if we go back. It's not easy. And sometimes we have to decide where to decide that. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, very interesting to hear that we are not the only ones that struggle with things sometimes.
Definitely. So just before we wrap up, let's have a sort of forward-thinking, positive note to end on. So if I could ask you, what would be the one piece of advice that you wished you'd had early on in your career about making mistakes? And how would you now give that to younger members of our profession to help them move forward with their surgical training? So, Ricardo.
Difficult, because I think that you need to be lucky as well, and the system needs to be on your side for you to be surrounded with a supportive team. But ultimately, I think that is to accept that mistakes can happen for various reasons. In veterinary medicine, starting from the surgeon, from the owner, and ending in the patient itself. So those three variables can contribute for things to go wrong. I always say that managing complications starts with the first consult. I think that is a very important thing. So you need to prepare yourself as much as possible with as much information as possible and plan. And then if you have complications, if you do mistakes, try to learn from them. Don't hide from them. Just talk about them. I think that's when I miss a diagnose nowadays or I struggle to get one, I try to be open about it. No shame on that. Complications are part of our passion. Sometimes wrong, never in doubt. No. And so just that is what will make you learn. And that we are in medicine, so we need to keep learning. It's not just staying on what was told us 10 years ago or 5 years ago. I think that is a continuous process. It's a commitment that we have. But yeah, mainly that, I think that read about your cases, study about them, understand the inside outs on everything, not just technicality. I see one of the biggest mistakes, I think, that is sometimes wanting to learn the technique when the technique is the easiest part. I think that the difficult part is going around that, no? Because complications, you can rescue a lot of them if you understand them. If you don't understand them, is when things go bad, I think.
Yeah, definitely. Kelly, Chris, have you got anything that you would add to that?
Yeah, I guess, you know, the fundamental role of the certificate and postgraduate training is to build on what's just been said. You know, anyone can learn to do surgery. Surgery isn't hard. You just need to do one step, then the next step. But what makes a difference is how to put all those things together to address complications, to make sure that the whole patient care pathway is correct from admission to discharge. That's the hard bit, not doing the surgery. And I guess to add that it's okay to be scared. There's a good amount of pressure. Too much pressure is not great because you don't perform well. And no pressure is not great because then there's no challenge and there's no focus. So having a good amount of pressure in your job is good for growth and fulfillment and development. And certainly for me, I think if you ever are not a little, if you're ever not a little scared when you go into theatre, then it's time to stop, really. I think that's normal.
Agree.
Yeah, me too. I think the most important is complications. We all have complications. The important is to learn with them, okay? And try to do better the next time, okay? Because if you do surgery, you will have complications. There's no way that doesn't happen. No way. So Learn that.
That's brilliant. Thank you all so much for sharing your stories and insights today. I've personally learned a lot and it's been incredibly valuable to hear all the sort of common threads between veterinary and human medicine, but also the unique perspectives across your different disciplines. So for those listening, we hope this discussion has given you some reassurance that the
pressures and challenges you face in practice are shared across professions and even within specialisms, but that there are strategies and support systems you can learn from and depend upon. Most of all, we hope that you take away that mistakes and difficult decisions don't define us. It's how we respond, learn, and support each other that really matters. So thank you for joining us. We'll see you again next time.
Thank you for listening to this podcast, raising incredibly important but often difficult conversations. We know that talking about suicide can bring up a lot of emotions, and if you're feeling overwhelmed, please remember, you don't have to face it alone. If you or someone you know is struggling, Samaritans are available 24/7. You can call them for free on 116 123 or visit samaritans.org for more ways to access support. If you work in the veterinary profession in the UK, VetLife provides confidential support tailored to your needs. Their helpline is open 24 hours a day at 0303 0402 551. And you can find more resources at vetlife.org.uk. Please look after yourselves. And if today's conversation resonated with you, we encourage you to share it with someone who might find it helpful. You're not alone. We'll see you next time.